Welcome back to the Faculty Factory podcast. I'm Kim Skorupski here at Hopkins looking at my friend Karen Monez. Karen, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
So Karen Monez, she and I met last summer at the AAMC, the Association of American Medical Colleges Group on Faculty Affairs Professional Development Conference in Palm Springs, California. We got to chatting and I learned all about Karen. She is the former Faculty and Staff Development Program Director for about 5 years in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Alberta. She is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine in Alberta, and she has a bachelor's, a master's, and now real close to finishing her PhD in health sciences education. Right, Karen?
That's right.
Okay. So I'm so happy you're here with us. Thanks so much for chatting with me and when we were in Palm Springs and being open to my kind of saying, come on, you need to be in the podcast. You were so kind in mentioning the podcast, and it always just warms my heart when I meet people who know about it and who are part of our community. And so thank you so much again, Karen, for just volunteering to be here and share your wisdom with us and kind of grow in the community again. And I'm going to let you start leading us off on a really an interesting and a new topic for us, the value of teaching and teacher identity in medical education. So thanks again, Karen. Take it away.
Thank you so much, Kim. It's certainly my absolute pleasure to be here. It's such an honor, and I'm so excited to talk your ear off a little bit more about my favorite topics in medical education and how I got to be interested in medical education scholarship. So, you know, I have a lot of work experience. I started out with a bachelor's in nutrition, which led me to some roles in cardiology, acute care, community health services, many, many years of teaching at the university level in healthcare. And those roles paved the way for me to complete a master's degree in health sciences education. So the more I learned about it, the more passionate I got and the more interested I got. And I think teachers can relate to this because it's such a fulfilling type of work. And so by doing that, I ended up as the director of faculty development there at the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Alberta. And the teaching experiences, which I really love, focused on clinical teachers and how we support this kind of work. And so through those faculty development experiences and my current role as assistant professor, it just fueled my passion even more because I could see how much clinicians love to teach, but I could also see there were some little hiccups and things we had to work around. And I just kind of wondered, you know, what we could do to make things better, to assist the faculty members to develop their skills, and where we could go for that. So we tried really, really hard. And I think it's really important to support teachers because they are so important to what comes after. So I think many of us in healthcare can remember a teacher or two that had a big impact on our development, if you just think back. And sometimes that experiential learning, rather than reading a set of instructions, having someone there under their guidance to help you learn, it can really optimize your learning experience and really be something effective. So when you think of a great teacher, why did you think they were great? What was it about them? What did they do for you? And then working with them, you start to think, well, how did they get that way? How do they become a teacher? Why do they become a teacher? And as a learner, why was that important to you? You know, you could watch a YouTube video, you know, why is this person so important in your life? And so you start asking questions when you start to support teachers and help them with their development. And you wonder who influenced them or who enables them, who made them believe that they were being a teacher and that's who they were. Like, it's their identity. I am a teacher. I am a nurse. I am a doctor. I am. What are you? So where did you get that recipe to become? Is it a role model? Was it somebody that, man, I want to be like you? when I get there. Was it a valuable experience, something that really made change the trajectory of your career? Or was it the group you were hanging out with, like a family or social group or culture, like a professional culture that we have, that socialized them to internalize these shared values and beliefs and behaviors that make them do what they do, and which is teaching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's almost my nutrition background. It's almost like it's going to be a food metaphor. How do you learn to make a favorite family recipe? Like, let's say something fancy like a chiffon cake. Now, there's some tricks to some of these complex procedures like we have in other areas of our life. So if you have somebody with expertise who facilitates this, it makes it much easier. It's very helpful, especially when there's some surprises along the way, which happens in every part of our lives. So this person with expertise to facilitate us is really helpful. So if you're fortunate enough to have a parent, grandparent, special teacher that helps you out, their knowledge, expertise, their tips and tricks, their praxis or their practical wisdom, it really comes in handy. And they're things you remember, and it makes it meaningful. So when it comes to translating that knowledge, mobilizing that knowledge for a procedure that you're doing or whatever you're learning, it has more meaning. And you probably can do better than if you tried to do this by yourself. So now back to medical education. We know that clinicians have to provide healthcare in a pressurized, busy, noisy environment, but they also have to teach our future clinicians as part of their job. So they're doing clinical work, which they're trained for, but they don't get a whole lot of teacher training. They just get thrown out there and say, there you go, teach. Okay. Good luck with that.
Because after all, you learned, right? So if you've had lots of teachers, you can just do it. It always cracks me up. It's like feeling like, well, I've watched lots of movies, so I can act. Surely I can act. I've seen lots of movies. I've seen lots of television shows. I've seen lots of teachers in action. I've held lots of teachers. I can do that. I've seen lots of sporting events. I can do that.
You got it. We can land a plane. We've seen it in the movies. I'd hate to try it without a little bit of training, though. But that's exactly right. We throw you out there in the clinic with learners, and some of the learners have to teach their junior colleagues, and we tell them to teach without any background. So is that valued? Mm-hmm. Some people think it's an add-on. It's an added-on role. It's maybe something you do on the side, you fit it in somehow, it's not a priority, but it does have implications for patient care, as far as quality and safety. So I think ultimately this is one of the shared values of medical culture is patient care and safety and the quality of that and us to optimize that. And so in that sense, it's valued, but the teachers aren't recognized. And so we need to look at teaching and how we value that. And how do we value that when your clinic is your classroom? Because it's not a quiet room where you sit in a chair and you listen to someone talk. Everything's going on all at once, all the time. And it's probably like being a parent where, you know, this is happening and you need that and you need to address something else. And all of these things are happening and it's high stakes. These are people's lives in your hands. So, you know, it would really be helpful to have that, you know, helper on your, guiding you along the way. So with these implications, we know that the clinicians who teach and who see themselves as teachers or identify as teachers or have a teaching identity, they are better teachers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking when clinical teaching is valued, this is my question, I'm thinking everybody wins if we value this. The individual, the patients, the learners, the institutions, we get better metrics coming out. People recover, we have beds available. You know, there's a lot of things that that have a domino effect from this. So looking at this root, we're looking at these clinicians, but not all these clinicians see themselves as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that is something that we question. And it's like, well, why not? It's part of your job. Why aren't we helping you with this? So when you follow the breadcrumbs back, I ended up looking at this in the literature, and it looks to me like clinical teachers belong to professional cultures. And so the answer could be somewhere in these professional cultures, because cultures ensure that the clinicians are socialized to form a professional identity. So we have all this work on professional identity formation. But in addition, we don't see much in socializing to develop that teacher identity that's part of your job. So we have faculty development. And to date, you know, we've been offering not only myself, everywhere, faculty developments are regularly offering sessions that focus on teacher training and opportunities to network with other teachers, so you can have this community of practice in your profession with other teachers to support each other and make a really good group. And interestingly, these wonderful things that we offer, attendance is not always optimal. So we build it, but not everybody comes. So attendance is a little low sometimes. And it's not the individuals that don't want to come. They many, many love teaching, but it's logistical things that have to do with institutional barriers. They're enthusiastic. They want the training. They want the resources, but you've got heavy workload. You've got time constraints. It's just not feasible to drive an hour for a faculty development session, have it for an hour, and drive back somewhere to the clinic for an hour. You lost half a day, and then you've lost, you know, a lot of appointments with your patients, and care gets delayed and things like that. So there's all these logistical things that we haven't considered. And so we don't necessarily enhance or make it easy. So it's hard for an individual to embrace the role, even though they want to. There's just not enough time in the day and not enough energy. So if we are not supporting teachers, how can this be good for the learners? And these learners are going to be our future clinicians. So what kind of outcomes are we looking at down the road when it's you and me and our families and our friends? What kind of care will we be getting if we don't build the right foundation? So it's, again, a question of patient care and safety.
Yeah. Karen, can I just interrupt you here? Because you're saying things that are just so, I think, spot on and timely in terms of recognizing and valuing education. And I like how you phrase it, socializing to develop a teacher identity. After all, we're all in academia, the academy. It's education is number one. But I think we have overlooked that and almost viewed our roles in teaching and education as kind of like a, well, of course, that's just part and parcel, as you pointed out, something that happens during the course of my seeing patients, working in the lab, you know, working in the classroom, or that's just kind of part of what I do. It's just, I don't think of it as an identity per se. I'm a professor, as you point out, in the department, professional society identity. So shifting that kind of emphasis, I think, is really critical. And I've mentioned before in the podcast here at Johns Hopkins, we have the Institute for Excellence in Education, IEE, which is led by our wonderful Dr. Joe Cofrancesco. And our Associate Dean for Faculty Educational Development, Dr. Rachel Levine, is working hand in glove with Joe and the IEE on these educator competencies. And there's a whole committee trying to elevate this awareness of educators to possibly being, ideally being, a promotion track in Hopkins. Historically, Hopkins had one research, one promotion track, the traditional research track, as we all know it. And then right before COVID, we came up with a clinical excellence track. So that's the second way one could be promoted here at Hopkins. So by your research, traditional track, and then clinical excellence. Well, we'd like to, in terms of like the tripartite mission, you know, research and clinical and education, we'd like to elevate educators to having their own promotion track. And as you're talking, Karen, I'm looking at the work done by Drs. Ko, Francesco, and Levine here at Hopkins, looking at domains of educators' work that include teaching and facilitating learning, program and curriculum development, assessment and evaluation, educational leadership, educational scholarship, and educational mentoring, coaching, advising. So these kind of six domains of competencies, you know, lend itself to that, you know, heightening the credibility or the awareness or the formality and institutionalizing this as a, this is a thing. This is not something you do in your spare time or on the fly or what you picked up through undergraduate, graduate, postgraduate, 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 postgraduate. It's not just, this is not how one becomes, as you're pointing out. And I just wanted, before I forget this, I love the metaphor of the chiffon cake. And what I also love about this notion that you're talking about of having a teacher identity is teachers, good teachers, bring out the best in the learners and meet the learners where they are. So it's not just giving a, like you said, on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube, a flat PowerPoint presentation and shoving the info at you. It's Karen, you know, noticing Karen's preferences for learning and her gifts and her blind spots and the things she's not confident about and kind of pulling that out and encouraging, inspire. That's a good teacher. And you're making me think about, again, the metaphor of the cooking, because we make a lot of assumptions as teachers and professionals. We make tons of assumptions. If I say, well, if you hand a learner a checklist of how to do this procedure or how to write this grant or how to submit this paper, and it's just like this list fashion, I'm making a lot of assumptions that Karen Manez knows what I mean when I say whip the batter versus stir the batter versus fold in the batter, whisk it or mix it. Those are different terms that does anybody, you have to have some amount of personal attention to make sure you understand. No, if it says stir, it's different from folding, whisking, mixing, or whipping. So these nuances of language and the assumptions one makes of where one is and what one understands, this is only captured when you really invest in and think carefully about education and yourself as an educator, right? And then I'm going to shut up and let you keep going.
Oh, it's wonderful. You hit the nail on the head. It's not just doing teaching. It's being a teacher. It's different. You know, a technician can do the checklist. Being has a different meaning, a different awareness, like you said. And unfortunately, like you say, it's assumed that you know what that means, but it's put to the side, and teaching is almost marginalized compared to other roles that we have as faculty. So I think because of the long-term implications that this has about how things could really go sideways, and we do see things, you know, at the other end when they're not quite right, that we could see, oh, we should have done these things differently. So we can do these things differently, but tradition is hard to change.
Well, earlier, Karen, you when you're starting off, you said with clinical teachers, you know, they love it, they have a passion for it, many do, but you said you noticed some hiccups. Mm-hmm. Can you remember or can you recall what you observed or what you noticed or what were you told about these hiccups that got you curious to explore this teacher competency and identity?
Right. You know, the attendance just seemed to dwindle at different points when we were offering things that were asked for and necessary. And we knew it wasn't because of the individual. It wasn't on the micro level. On the meso level or medium level or department level, there was some support where we could offer these things. And if you had a wonderful team, they would really get into it and dig down and find some wonderful sessions and really effective ways to create identity and a community of teachers to work together and even do a conference together of teachers in medical education. And yet that wasn't quite working. No matter how good it was with a bow on top, you just couldn't pull people away to get to it. So the mind was willing, but the body couldn't do it. So I started thinking about what the hiccup was, and I started to back up and look at the broader picture. It could be on a macro level. So we know that cultures work a certain way, of professional cultures, to meet the demands of the bigger picture, the macro, the metrics, the things we need to do. And so perhaps in that way, if we look at the bigger picture, I think we need to make teaching more visible at a higher level, to make the value more visible to a higher level, to say, what's in it for you? Because if we value teaching, everybody wins, you know, the learner, the patient, the teacher, the institution. Mm-hmm. So I think we're just assuming too many things. And, you know, we assume everyone knows how to do certain things. And I think we need to go back to the foundation, because that foundation needs a little bit of work, I think, from what we're seeing at the other end, at the hiccup end of things.
I love it. Such an important message, Karen. It really does give you pause to think. And I especially appreciate you talking about doing versus being. Are you doing teaching, or are you being a teacher? And I often think about that, the doing being, when I kind of admonish myself and the faculty members I coach, that, you know, reminding them we're human beings, not human doings. Yes. But this culture is so, not only are like our, you know, North American culture, but the academic medicine culture is doing, that you're not being anything unless you're doing. And then it's almost like this habituated busyness, the cult of busy, where if you're not busy doing something, you're not being productive. So we've gotten away from that idea of, as my colleague Rachel Levine always says, deep thinking. You know, what do you do during your 1 hour of deep thinking? She says, I think, comma, deeply. That we don't think about things, and we don't think about our identity. And like you said, something, if it's lower in value, we, by virtue of it being lower value, we spend less effort on it. We don't give it our A game. We bring our A game into the operating room or on the study section or at the international talk, but we don't necessarily bring our A game into the wards or in the classrooms or at the bedside, because and that's, I think, that awareness of, this is not just about you, it's not even about that learner, it's about the patient, it's about the reputation, it's about the experience, it's about the health of a population. It really has those profound ripple effects that I think you rightly pointed out, we forget about that.
Yeah. Are we overlooking this? Yeah. Because why are we busy doing? What's the quality in the end of the result of what we do? We were busy. We don't have time to exercise. We don't have time for balance. We're always on the run, checking everything. We're always booked solid. We have a busy day in the OR in the ward. But to what end? What did you produce? Is that patient going to be readmitted? You know, there's what was the end result of what we did? Was it to the best that we could? Did we tick every box? Did we cover all the bases properly before we let people out back into the world? Did we do the best we could?
And have we missed those opportunities because we're so busy? Those moments in time that could really have huge change, that moment where you see someone whose eyebrow is furrowed, a learner who like doesn't quite get it or feels has lack of confidence or is feeling anxious or is just stressed out and overwhelmed. And because we choose not to see that because we're so busy, you know, have we missed that learning moment, that one little extra bit of time or another way of thinking about something or giving another example could put that light bulb on. And now, boom, you've set someone on a trajectory that could, it's just huge. It's like watching one of those kind of weirdo movies where you have 10 different endings to, based on, you know, how you responded in that moment in time. And that sounds, we're all so hard on ourselves and we can beat ourselves up and go, oh, I wish I hadn't been so snotty. I think I've told this. I said something, I was rushing somewhere. It's a funny story. I can't remember what it is, but I said something. Oh, I remember I may have shared this on the podcast. When I was living in Chicago, I took the train as in Union Station. And I was, of course, always running to catch a train. Always, always. Because I'd have to take a shuttle from Rush University Medical Center down to the station and get the right train. And I was dying of thirst. And they had a little convenience store in the train station. And I went running in there and got a beverage from the thing. And I go up to the cash register. And, you know, I'm getting my money out. And the cashier says, do you want to donate a dollar or donate money to the for sick children? And I was like, no, I'm sorry. You know, I don't care much about sick children. And I stopped and he looked at me. I said, what did I say? I don't care too much about sick children. I was like, that's not what I meant. I do care about them. And then there was another incident at a grocery store where I was with somebody and they said, do you want to donate? And it was the same thing. I don't care about sick kids. And I'm like, what? That's not what I meant to say. But the point is like, slow down a minute. I don't even know why I'm telling the story, but the silly, beating ourselves up when we don't pause because we're busy. I'm going to miss the train. Oh my gosh, I've got another patient. I'm already backed up. I'm late for the Zoom call. I don't have time to really, that flew out of my face, like such a, you know, rude. And I'm sure that guy was like, I can't believe some woman came in here. She was running around. She was rushing. Said, I don't care about sick children. What's the state of the world coming to? So we beat ourselves up, but it's true. And I think, you know, we're going to mess up. And I guess I got to forgive myself for that. But it's a reminder, like, come on, really, what's really important that, you know, these things, why are we all here? Running through our lives.
And that's not what you meant, you know, that's not you. And when someone sees that, like say a learner, you're role modeling that to someone else. And so that's going to go on to the next batch of teachers or whoever it is, and it'll happen again. And it's not, you have to forgive yourself because this is how we are trained. This is how we are socialized. This is what we need to do to belong to this group of professionals that we're in. If you come in relaxed and say you have things under control and don't worry, I'm going to take a little extra time to do this with my learner, you're not really going to fit in. It's like, what's the matter with you? Where's your priorities? You know, like,
especially if you're not being paid for that effort, especially if you're thinking of like the clock is ticking and you're not generating sufficient RVU or you're not generating money for the institution and all that extra time that you spend with the fill in the blank learner, patient, colleague, whatever, I'm not getting paid for this. There was a time when we didn't care about those things, but now we have like this ticker going of like, how much money have you earned today for the institution? And so it's a competing pressures and demands, and it is a challenge, but I think you're right. We think about dropping into the fullness of like, why are we here? Why are we doing this? And where do we derive meaning and purpose and what fulfills us and what feels good? What seems right to us, and just taking like the gut check every once in a while. Why am I doing this? What am I doing?
Yeah.
Versus
and if we do a poor job, then we have to go back and redo it, which might cost the institution even more than doing it once. So it's something to think about, the way we were socialized to believe, to belong to this group. And like I said, back to tradition. Tradition is very hard to change, but and we show that to learners. When learners join a social group or professional group, we expect them to accept the norms and the values of the community members. And at McGill, Cruz in 2020 said that we expect them to acquire the identity prescribed by the group. So you must produce, you must hurry, you must not stop and smell the roses and help somebody with a question. And like you said, that learner that had the question, perhaps, you know, there'll be another learner that does get it and goes on to do the prescribed procedure in the prescribed way. But maybe that learner that had a question, maybe that's the learner that sees something different that will come up with a solution for you in the future, because they're not ticking boxes, because they're thinking deeply about really what's going on. And that's why they're taking a little more time to figure things out. So that's something maybe perhaps that we need to think a little bit more about. And these social groups, they're constructed and they function to perpetuate what they believe in, but they can evolve socially. And I think that's the good news, is that there's this chance to evolve. And I think evolving might be good in medical education. I have a story about my grandma, but once upon a time, my grandma gave me her medical textbook from 1918. And it was the prescribed way in that book how to do CPR, how it should be done. So the patient was supposed to lie on the floor with their arms by their sides, and then the practitioner was supposed to raise both arms over the patient's head and back down again until the problem was resolved. So exactly. So I'm really glad there was some evolution in cardiac care. It's a good thing.
I mean, I like this idea. What evolution, evolving and becoming. What are you becoming? What are we becoming? Mm-hmm. And yes, the blueprint for living, or culture, was, as we call it, how we do things around here. Culture can be one thing pushing us, and we can become something that can push back at that. So I want to make sure we don't lose the agency, the personal agency in this, because a lot of us, I know you probably learn the same thing and know the same thing every day in, day out with this, is feeling helpless because the system, the funds flow, the publishing, the grant chasing, the patient care. I mean, these pressures are immense and they're real. And we have power. We have agency. We can become something, and our becoming in the micro level, or as you pointed out, Karen, like as a social or a meso level, can push back to a macro, and we can get there. So you got me super. I got goosebumps. I'm charged up. I want to go teach something.
Yeah, if you know what they say, you know, culture can change policy. So if we can start with our own profession in our own communities, you know, we can take little steps, do it in little bites, to redesign some of the workplace cultures, even on the unit level, and have that spread, or be an example of how this can work. Pilot it, try it, see if your results are better, demonstrate better metrics. So I think, you know, we can see what's in it for all of us to consider these kind of little incremental changes without getting, running into roadblocks ourselves. And if we can refresh these workplace cultures so that institutions can better support teacher identity development, not the doing, because everybody says, well, just go learn how to do curriculum, go learn how to do a survey. That's a technical thing. Being a physician, being a practitioner, being a teacher is more than just a checkbox. You have the wisdom, you have judgment, and it's part of the same thing in the teaching profession as well, especially in medical education, because they fit together so nicely. So if we consider the features of the workplace, the pressures, like you said, they're very real pressures that are daily to show your productivity. And if we can look at those forces that enable productivity, the innovation might support your effectiveness, and that could enhance the organizational value, build your talent from within. It could be strategic for your workforce planning as well. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, enhance patient safety and care.
Love it. Karen Manez, I love this. This is a great message. It was so timely. You fill my heart with joy. I'm so excited to think more about being a teacher and how I can get that. Because I started off as a teacher with my siblings. I turned our family room as a child into a library. I gave them homework assignments. I graded them. I had little rubrics. I was just off the wall. I knew I was a teacher from day one. And I feel like, you know, through my faculty development role, I've gotten away from that. But this is kind of one of those things in life when you think about purpose and meaning and why am I here? And sometimes those things that we love when we were younger, you know, riding a bike and going on walks and painting or whatever, we get away from those things. And I feel like I've gotten away from being in the classroom, as it were. So you've kind of opened my eyes to something that I can explore to revisit. So Karen Manez, I just want to leave the last word to you, and I really appreciate you. And thank you so much for being in the Faculty Factory podcast. Why don't you say goodbye to all of us and till the next time?
Well, thank you so much, Kim. It's been such an honor and pleasure talking with you. And I just hope we all think a little bit more about being teachers and role models. And I hope that we can talk again as we develop some new ideas and innovations. Thank you so much.
Hey everyone, it's your podcast producer, Casey. Just wanted to let you know that as of March 1st, 2024, this podcast has had nearly 89,000 total downloads and YouTube views from listeners in 95 different countries. The website, facultyfactory.org, has drawn over 41,000 web visits from users in 122 different countries. I tell you all of this just to underscore the point that this truly is an international platform, and we want to invite you, no matter where you are in the world, to be a guest on our show. Our host, Dr. Skorupski, makes the experience very engaging, relaxing, and fun. As producer, I'll make any of the edits that you might need on the back end before we publish it. We want to hear from different faculty around the world and learn from each other, so please reach out if you'd like to be a guest or to nominate someone in our academic medicine community to be a guest. You can visit the Contact Us page on facultyfactory.org to send us a message, or contact Dr. Skorupski directly at kskorupski@jhmi.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. The mission of the Faculty Factory is to build and support a community of leaders in faculty development who share tools, resources, wisdom, and encouragement in service to our faculty members, schools, and institutions. We encourage you to go to facultyfactory.org to find out more, get in touch with me, ask me any questions. Maybe you want to be interviewed on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Faculty Factory podcast and website is sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine Office of Faculty. For more information, visit facultyfactory.org.